Thanks very much, Paul and Richard. Good to be with you. Thank you, Alicia. Got to meet Alicia back in November in Georgia. She hitched a ride with a group of us who were going to an apologetics conference. So we had a kind of a crazy time getting there, trying to figure out where we were on the map and so forth. But we got there, and it's been a lot of fun to keep in touch with Alicia. Thanks for all your work in promotion of this talk. And also want to say, where is he? Kevin, Brandon, where'd you go, guy? My webmaster here, he does a lot of work, a labor of love, and he lives in the Toronto area, so nice to have him out. My wife and I and our youngest son, Jonathan, we spent about a week with them when we came out for a wedding in the summer, so nice to see you again. And again, thanks to all of you who have been a part in inviting me to come and putting on this lectureship. I'm very grateful to be here. And as I discuss this topic of Old Testament ethics, there is I'm kind of working against tradition here in the sense that there is a kind of Sunday school version of the issues of slavery and genocide in the Old Testament. And I stay away from those terms because they are a misrepresentation of what is actually going on in the Old Testament. And so I hope to clarify some of those issues and portray the character of God fairly and rightly. And as you may well know, if you've read any of these new atheists like Richard Dawkins or Christopher Hitchens or Sam Harris, they are regularly taking pot shots at the Old Testament God. Indeed, many people, as I speak on university campuses, when I speak, and then I have the open forum, time for question and answer afterwards, one of the first things that typically comes up is, well, what about a God who commands the killing of the Canaanites? Here you've been talking about the moral argument for God's existence, and then they'll bring up the question of the Canaanites. You know, all that hard work, and then they bring this up. Well, what do we do about it? Well, hopefully, as we discuss this tonight, we'll have some insight and clues into what is actually going on. And what I'm encouraging people to do is not kind of gloss over or maybe have some sort of an explanation of what's going on that really isn't in the text. What I'm asking people to do is look more closely at the biblical text, and you'll see something quite remarkable. So I'd like to speak about the topic first, slavery, and then genocide. Harriet Beecher Stowe was the famed author of the book Uncle Tom's Cabin. That was a kind of an emotional expose of Southern slavery in the antebellum South. When Abraham Lincoln met her, when she came to the White House, he purportedly said, "So you're the little woman who wrote the book that started this great war." And Stowe described Southern slavery in this way. She said, "The legal power of the master amounts to an absolute despotism over body and soul, and there is no protection for the slave's life." And unfortunately, when Christians and non-Christians alike read the Old Testament text, they see the term slavery used repeatedly. What typically comes to mind is something akin to the antebellum Southern arrangement or institution of slavery. And it is very misleading. A lot of people will send me questions about translation issues. And I'll say, actually, slavery is not a very good word to be used in the Old Testament. And it is one of the things that Sam Harris says that slaves are human beings who are capable of suffering and of experiencing happiness. Yet the Old Testament regards them as farm equipment, which is patently evil. So there is that perception on the part of the new atheist Sam Harris. What I'd like to do as I look at slavery is to first have a general understanding of what's going on in Old Testament slavery and then look at two or three critical texts that are typically pointed to by the critic to try to expose the immorality of slavery in the Old Testament. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to address the issue of slavery in the New Testament, which is another animal. This is indeed slavery as, you know, slaves as property under the Roman Empire. I do have a chapter in my book on that, but I won't go into that here because I also need to cover the topic of the Canaanites. But let me give a few general remarks about the Old Testament institution of servitude, and then we'll look at the question of the Canaanites. In the Old Testament, the institution that we see in the Law of Moses is Hebrew debt servitude. Many translations render this slavery, but this is, as I said, this could be compared to an apprentice-like position to pay off debts. So slavery is not a good term for this. Think about people coming to the New World from Europe. And what they would do is they would not be able to pay, not be able to pay off their passage. And so they would come work here after they made their way to the New World and then pay off their debts, say, in around 7 years. And then they were free to come and go as ordinary citizens who had their contractual obligations taken care of. This is the same sort of arrangement that we have in the Old Testament. Servitude is not something that is a matter of ownership. It is a matter of contract. It is when somebody hires himself out. And even if you talk about buying and selling or whatever, if someone sells himself into servitude, you might read in Leviticus 25. Well, this is the kind of selling of oneself like a player who might sell himself to a team. Teams have owners and so forth. And we don't think that a person is property just because we use the language of team owners or buying a player or something like that. And so as we look at the Old Testament, we see that slavery, or better, servitude, is entered into voluntarily. Someone sells himself. Now, what about passages where it talks about if a man sells his daughter? Now, what kind of a decent father would do that to his daughter? Well, the sort of arrangement that you have is genuine. There's genuine poverty that sets the context for this. There is destitution. A person has no alternative. What can he do? Doesn't have any land, doesn't have a house, doesn't have any money, his crops have failed. Well, he parcels out his family to relatives, to friends nearby, and they provide food, clothing, shelter, and a means to pay off that debt. And they have the security of that home in the meantime. The cap on the debt was 7 years. That you could not go beyond that unless the servant entered into an agreement to make it permanent. And you have the ceremony at the end of Exodus 21 that talks about the gouging of the ear, the piercing of the ear, where an awl is taken to the ear and put against the door in front of the judges, and it is made an official arrangement that it becomes permanent. But the important thing to remember here is that servanthood was not imposed by an outsider, as it was in the antebellum South. Indentured servants could be, as Leviticus 25 said, hired from year to year and weren't to be ruled over ruthlessly. And to impose lifelong servitude on, say, a fellow Israelite was not permitted. The legal status of the servant in Israel was unique in the rest of the ancient Near East. It is a dramatic improvement over ancient Near Eastern law codes. One scholar says Hebrew has no vocabulary of slavery, only servanthood. And so Israel, even though it had this, it had this safety net of protecting the poor so that they could work themselves out of debt and have a place to live, to thrive, to be fed and clothed for a period of 7 years so they could get themselves out of debt. This was not intended to be a hammock where people could just relax or an institution that was to be perpetuated, but it was a temporary safeguard to prevent permanent destitution and servitude. Servants had dignity in Israel. Israel's laws were concerned about regulating servitude rather than institutionalizing it. Israel prohibited forced slavery, as we'll see shortly. The Old Testament legislation sought to prevent voluntary debt servitude in a number of different ways. There were a number of ways in which Israel's laws sought to make it easier for the poor to get out of debt, to sustain themselves and so forth. So you have things like gleaning laws, where the poor could go to the edges of the fields that hadn't been completely mowed down, and they could gather grain for themselves or pick fruit from trees that were to be left there, that they were not to be picked clean by their owners. Israelites were not to be charged interest. They were to be, and debts were to be automatically canceled every 7 years. And in the year of Jubilee, the 50th year, the land would revert to its owner, so that land could not be accumulated over the generations, but it was to be given back to the original owners every 50 years. So as one person puts it, for the first time in the ancient Near East, as we read the law of Moses, we see how servants are to be treated at the very beginning of the Mosaic law code in Exodus 21. So you have, right after the giving of the Ten Commandments, you have how servants are to be treated, rather than being relegated to the very back of the law codes, as was the case in other ancient Near Eastern codes. You have the Mosaic law code that talks about the treatment and the dignity of the servant. As one scholar puts it, we have in the Bible for the first appeals in world literature to treat slaves as human beings for their own sake and not just in the interests of their masters. We began talking about Abraham Lincoln and Southern slavery. Abraham Lincoln, in his second inaugural address, talked about how the North and the South, both, it says that both of them read the same Bible, prayed to the same God, but yet the prayers of both could not be answered by God. One side both sides could not be in the right. One of the things that I like to point out is that if there were three fundamental regulations kept in the law of or preserved in the law of Moses for us that were carried out in the West by, say, colonial powers, slavery would not have been an issue. A lot of people said, well, you've got people who are reading the same Bible, they're appealing to the same texts, but yet some say slavery is wrong, others say slavery is right. What I would say is, if you read the biblical text more closely, the practice of slavery evaporates. And let me explain why. In the first place, there were anti-harm laws that if you brought harm to your servant, if you gouged out his eye, knocked out his tooth, that servant was to be let go and the debt was to be canceled. We see this in Exodus 21. Injured servants were to be released. Now, if this were to be practiced in the antebellum South, that the kind of treatment that is often spoken about in Uncle Tom's Cabin and in the literature elsewhere would not have taken place at all. We would not be reading about that. We know about the horrendous treatment of those, and you sometimes see pictures of people who are just whipped without mercy, and you see the scars on the back to prove it. So the first law that was not typically kept in the pre-Civil War South was that of the anti-harm law. Also, in both Exodus and Deuteronomy, we read about anti-kidnapping laws. Now, how did slavery get started in the West? Well, people were kidnapped. They were taken against their will from their country and brought to a new place to which they did not want to come. But yet we see in the law of Moses a condemnation of kidnapping that was punishable by death. Kidnapping, as I said, was how slavery in the South got started. But as Exodus 21 says, he who kidnaps a man, whether he sells him or is found in his possession, he shall surely be put to death. Then there are the anti-return laws. Unlike the antebellum South, Israel was to offer safe harbor to runaway foreign slaves in Deuteronomy 23. Again, a marked contrast with the United States fugitive slave law. Indeed, in the ancient Near East, the Code of Hammurabi in Babylon demanded that the death penalty would be given to those who helped runaway slaves who harbored them as fugitives. The Old Testament scholar Christopher Wright observes, no other ancient Near Eastern law has been found that holds a master to account for the treatment of his own slaves, and the otherwise universal law regarding runaway slaves was that they must be sent back with severe penalties for those who failed to comply. Runaway slaves even had greater latitude in Israel because they could settle in any of the cities which they chose to live in Israel. The Israelites themselves had to live within their own tribal territories, but runaway foreign slaves could settle in whatever cities they could manage to find a place. If these three clear laws from Exodus and Deuteronomy had been followed in the South, slavery would have been a non-issue. Now, I want to examine a few of the difficult texts. There is one that is mentioned, Exodus 21, verses 20 and 21. Let me just read that briefly. It says, if a man strikes his male servant or his female servant with a staff so that he or she dies as a result of the blow, he will surely be punished. However, if the injured servant survives one or two days, the owner, the employer, will not be punished, for he has suffered the loss. Now, a lot of people look at that and say, boy, that's kind of harsh. Well, a lot of times they don't read what precedes it. And this is in the context of accidental deaths or injury. And in the case of accidental death or injury, what you have is, in the previous case, you have the person who has been responsible for harming someone actually showing care by paying the medical expenses for the person who is injured. And so in this text, we have kind of a continuation of that theme. And so when you read that this person had suffered the loss, it's probably the same sort of thing that this person is trying to show, the employer is trying to show that he was not intending to take anyone's life, and so is actually paying the medical bills to show that the intention was not to kill or to maim or anything like that. And so that would be taken under consideration by the judge. But it's interesting that if the employer strikes his employee so that he dies immediately, and again, this is stunning in the ancient Near East, then that person who took his life was to be put to death. That is what the word nakam in the Hebrew is. He will surely be punished. And again, this is always used of a death penalty scenario. So there is not this permission to simply beat slaves and within an inch of their life and say, oh, he survived, he's okay. Nothing like that. There's actually a lot more to be discussed in that. And I can't get into a lot more detail because I am, like the Egyptian mummy, pressed for time here. So I'll try to wrap things up. I know I have an unfairo advantage being the speaker. Some of you are in a state of denial here. All right. All right. There's another portion that is typically raised with regard to, you know, again, harsh sounding scenarios of in the treatment of servants. This is one of them. And it seems to be advocating that a wife and child could be left behind once the male servant is set free. This is Exodus 23. If you buy a Hebrew servant, again, this is if someone, it's a voluntary sort of thing, but you make this contractual arrangement. He is to serve you for 6 years, but in the seventh year, he will go out free without paying anything. If he came in by himself, he'll go out by himself. If he had a wife when he came in, then his wife will go out with him. If his master gave him a wife and she bore sons or daughters, the wife and the children will belong to her master, and he will go out by himself. But if the servant should declare, I love my master, my wife, and my children, I will not go out free, then his master must bring him to the judges. He will bring him to the door of the doorposts, and his master will pierce his ear with an awl, and he shall serve him forever, which we've already touched on. Now, in this case, a person might sell himself or even his wife or children to help a person to help them get out of debt. But again, it was a contractual arrangement for a certain amount of time, 7 years maximum. But here it seems that Well, aren't you practicing what the Civil War era slavery was all about, namely the separating of families from each other? It was a home wrecking kind of scenario, and slave masters did this intentionally so that there couldn't be these attachments between the slaves and their families. But what we have here, some people wonder, also think it's maybe gender bias too, that the male gets the advantage, the female gets left behind. How is that fair? Well, we have to have good reason to think that this passage isn't gender specific. In fact, various scholars suggest that this alternate reading could be presented, in kind of case law issues. If you buy a Hebrew servant, she is to serve you for 6 years. But in the seventh year, she will go out free. If her master gives her a husband and they have sons or daughters, the husband and the children will belong to her master and she will go out by herself. Secondly, this scenario isn't as harsh as it first appears. Let me just stick for the sake of argument with the male servant scenario. By taking the male servant into his home to work off the debt, the boss has made an investment and he would stand to suffer loss if he simply let the servant walk out on the contract. In military service, if you have a contractual agreement, you don't say, hey, just got married. I'd like to be alleviated or relieved of my military duties. No, you've got to fulfill that contract. The same sort of thing here. The employer is going to suffer loss otherwise. So it doesn't make sense to let a man go with his family without paying off this debt. Thirdly, the released man has three options. He could wait for his wife and kids to finish their term of service while he worked elsewhere. Now, remember, the wife and the kids weren't stuck in the employer's home for the rest of their lives. They had to be released when the wife worked off her debt, because she is also a fellow servant. But the now free man could work elsewhere, but this would mean he would be separated from his family, and the boss would no longer supply him with food, clothing, and shelter. On the other hand, if he lived with his family after the release, he would still have to pay for room and board. So this scenario created its own set of financial challenges. Also, another alternative, he could get a decent job elsewhere, save his shekels to pay his boss to release his wife and kids from contractual obligations. But the problem here is that it would have been very difficult for the man to support himself and to earn enough money for his family's debt release. A third alternative, one that we just read, is that he could commit himself to working permanently for his employer, a lifetime contract. And he could stay with his family and remain in a fairly stable economic circumstance, formalizing his intent in a legal ceremony before the judges, or God, as the text says, having his ear pierced with an awl. So those are a couple of scenarios in which we see servitude. When you look at it more closely, you realize it's not the kind of arrangement that a lot of critics say it is. It is not harsh, brutal, and severe, but rather it is something that really looks out for those who are in poverty in Israel, in light of the destitution that they're experiencing. These are people who are being cared for by the laws of Israel. There's one more text, and I'm just going to have to go very briefly on it because I want to get into the question of the Canaanites. And it's this, in Leviticus 25, 42 to 46, it seems that slaves from foreign nations could be kind of bought and sold in Israel. It says, as for your female and male slaves whom you may have, you may acquire male and female slaves from the pagan nations that are around you. Then, too, it is out of the sons of the sojourners who live as aliens among you that you may gain acquisition out of their families who are with you, whom they have produced in your land. They also may become your possession. Now, this is a text that troubles a lot of people, but as I said, the more closely we look at what is going on in this text and elsewhere in texts just preceding it, we start to see a different picture. According to Leviticus 19, just a few chapters earlier, Israel is told to love the stranger in the land. Also, Exodus's laws were to protect abuse of all persons in service, not just the Jews. In fact, the passage that I just talked about, the Hebrew servant in Exodus 21, that term Hebrew technically refers to not just someone who is a Jew, who is ethnically related to Abraham, but this term could be used of any person who did not have any sort of political allegiance or national ties, but was kind of an in-between in no man's land. this was the sort of person, you know, the Habiru, the Hebrew. It had not yet been formed into the more technical understanding, of someone who is actually the offspring of Abraham. And so here, you know, even in that text where you have this 7-year contractual agreement, if it does seem to be speaking of a foreigner here, and what you have is permission, or basically a contractual obligation to let that person go after 7 years. So you have, even earlier on in the text, indications that those who serve as foreigners have a maximum cap of 7 years. But this seems to be talking about something that is more permanent. Those who have said, I love my master, and they continue to stay within the family generation after generation. Again, for those who don't have land, and foreigners who came to Israel could not have their own land, it belonged first and foremost to God, but the Israelites could have a part in that. But the land had to belong to the Israelites and not to foreigners. So they could either leave, or they could, again, one safe arrangement was to just live within the homes of their hosts in Israel. Also, the term acquire does not have to involve selling or purchasing persons as property. We see that, for example, Eve has acquired a man-child with the help of the Lord. Certainly not a matter of property. Or God is seen as the possessor of heaven and earth, the same word that's used in Genesis 14:19. Boaz acquired Ruth as a wife. It was a legal transaction, but certainly nowhere a matter of property by any means. It's interesting, the term sojourners and aliens is used in this passage. But then it goes on to say in verse 47 that these aliens and sojourners, it says, if they become persons of means, they are not to put Israelites into servitude. Notice this. Here these aliens and sojourners are ones who can work as servants within the households of Israel, but they can also work themselves out of their debt and become persons of means. So this is not at all intended to be something that is permanent against their will and so forth. Furthermore, we even read of cases where there are foreign servants who become elevated and apparently fully equal to Israelite citizens. In fact, one of Caleb's descendants we read about in 1 Chronicles 2, where it says, Now Shishan had no sons, only daughters, and Shishan had an Egyptian servant whose name was Yarha. Shishan gave his daughter to Yarha, his servant, in marriage, and she bore him Atai. So here you have someone, a foreign servant, who is married to an established free person with quite a pedigree, Caleb's offspring. And the key implication here is that inheritance rights would fall to the servant's offspring, Atai. So there's a lot that is going on here that is very significant. And to simply write this off as, a buying and selling of persons as chattel slaves, this is not at all what the text is saying. But I must go on. I'm going to have to press on. I'm going to skip over some of the other comments that I would have wanted to make to talk about the question of Canaanite genocide. Let me read from Deuteronomy 20, verses 16 to 18. This is probably one of the key texts that is mentioned in this regard. Only the cities of these people that the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance, you shall not leave alive anything that breathes. But you shall utterly destroy them, the Hittite and the Amorite, the Canaanite and the Perizzite, the Hivite and the Jebusite, as the Lord your God has commanded you, in order that they may not teach you to do according to all their detestable things which they have done for their gods, so that you would sin against the Lord your God. Richard Dawkins talks about this passage in his book, The God Delusion, and he mentions this in reference to ethnic cleansing. He refers to those bloodthirsty massacres carried out with xenophobic relish, hatred toward outsiders. Well, let me just make a few introductory comments here. As we look at the Canaanites, we're not saying that they are the worst specimens of humanity that ever existed or that even were around in the ancient Near East. The act that God commanded was unique and unrepeatable. It was not to set a precedent for warfare throughout Israel's existence. Indeed, it does not set a precedent. Just historically, Israelites did not take this as a pretext for future wars in their history. But even so, God, we're told in Genesis 15, waited patiently for the sin of the Amorite to be filled up, for it to be ripened. God allowed Israel to go through slavery in Egypt in order for them to wait until the time when the sin of the Canaanites was ripe and ready to be judged. So this is a 400-year wait that we are talking about. And so God, in doing this, accomplished two things. He brought judgment upon Canaanites, a kind of corporate capital punishment. But the destruction was directed less against Canaanite persons as it was against Canaanite religion. The Canaanite gods and goddesses engaged in all kinds of sexual acts, including incest and bestiality. And not surprising, worshippers of these deities engaged in ritual prostitution, not to mention infant sacrifice and other deviant acts. In our sex-saturated culture, a lot of people don't seem all that concerned about sexual immorality and the destruction that it wreaks on individuals, families, and society. People might get upset about racism, about gender discrimination, but our moral instincts are often jaded when it comes to such soul-destroying activities as adultery and prostitution. God's anger at society's moral and spiritual suicide mission is in this context, God is saying enough. And actually, God's bringing judgment is a sign of his moral concern. Secondly, God is able to prepare a land for his people to create the proper religious setting to make sense out of a coming Messiah who would bring redemption to the Israelites, Jews and also Gentiles. God promised Abraham that he would be the means of blessing to all the families of the earth in Genesis 12:3. Who are the intended recipients of salvation? Jews, yes, but also Israel's most hostile enemies. We see in the Old Testament, Assyria and Egypt are mentioned as God's people in Isaiah chapter 19. Babylon and Philistia are also included in this. What's more, even the Canaanites are incorporated into the new Israel, the true people of God. In the Psalms, as well as in Zechariah 9:6, the Jebusite, who has been assimilated into Israel, is part of the people of God. So the killing of the Canaanites, let's just put it out on the table, is not racially motivated, but rather theologically and morally motivated. So it is not at all to be understood as genocide by a long shot. Now, what I'd like to do is point out a few kind of bullet points here to go through to put into perspective what these commands are all about. The typical, I'll talk first about infiltration, internal struggle, and conquest. The typical Sunday school version of the Canaanite story assumes a military engagement that was the only means of taking the land. Many evangelical scholars, however, reject this military-only model. They recognize that the biblical text refers to some type of infiltration, that it is a gradual process that is taking place here, and that there is an internal struggle that we see in Judges 1 and 2. The Canaanites continued to live in the land. The biblical text makes that clear. One Old Testament scholar, David Howard at Bethel University, Bethel Seminary, he says that we see more than a simple conquest model, but rather a mixed picture of success and failure, sudden victory and slow compromised progress. He said that the Israelites entered Canaan and they did engage militarily, but without causing extensive material destruction. So we can't simply consider this a matter of the Canaanite conquest. In fact, archaeologically speaking, what we see is a gradual infiltration and assimilation over several centuries, at the end of which point, Yahweh is the recognized national name. It takes a while to get to that point. And when we look at the archaeology, we don't see just a dramatic overrunning of the Canaanite cities and destroying them. We actually see an assimilation, a moving into homes. There is not the destruction that our minds often conjure up as we read the biblical text. But as we read it more closely, we see that this is indeed not happening because there is internal struggle, that there are a lot of Canaanites still left standing. Another bullet point has to do with the ancient Near Eastern warfare rhetoric. And I think this is very, very critical for us to understand. Any conquest of Canaan is going to be far less widespread and harsh than many people assume. Let me give you a text here, and then we'll unpack it. Joshua 10:40. It says, "Thus Joshua struck all the land, the hill country and the Negev, and the lowland and the slopes and all their kings. He left no survivor. He utterly destroyed all who breathed, just as the Lord, the God of Israel, had commanded." So we think, oh, nobody's left standing. Nobody's left behind. It's a total obliteration, right? No. Ancient Near Eastern rhetoric suggests that you could win by a very narrow margin and still talk about slaughtering your enemies, not leaving alive anyone and anything that breathed. In fact, one king of Moab, we have an inscription of what he depicted. And he said that Israel, after a battle that they had, is no more. Israel is no more. Well, we know that was quite the exaggeration. Israel continued to go on and to varying degrees, survived and even flourished. But we don't see anything resembling Israel is no more as being literally true. In fact, as we look at the biblical text, we see that Joshua, the language of Joshua, is one that that talks about nations that still remain among you. At the end of Joshua, he's talking about these nations that still remain among you. He talks about not leaving any survivor, but then he talks as though there are lots of Canaanites around. And we go on to read in Judges, that says they could not drive out the Jebusites. They did not take possession. They did not drive them out completely. God says, "I will not drive them out before you." In fact, these nations remained to this day. By the time of writing, they were still around. So what is going on here? You have very strong language that says leave alive, or we left alive nothing that breathed. But on the other hand, you've got lots of Canaanites still around. Really, it illustrates that the notion of the gradual assimilation, infiltration and so forth makes better sense than talking about a total conquest model. Now, as I said before, even in that God was interested more in destroying Canaanite religion than God was interested in destroying Canaanites. In Deuteronomy chapter 7, it's interesting, you see this very nicely juxtaposed, where at first God begins by telling them to utterly destroy the Canaanites, and then it goes on to say, and do not intermarry with them. Do not worship their gods. Do not make treaties with them. Well, what's going on? Did God intend that they be wiped out? Or does God have something more fundamental here in mind? Namely, don't get pulled down by Israelite religion and morality. God is more interested in destroying Canaanite religion than in Canaanite peoples. Now, some people will say, well, maybe that's the case there, but what about the Amalekites? In 1 Samuel 15, you have Saul, who is criticized. In fact, his kingship is taken from him because of his disobedience to God. And he disobeys God because he has not, apparently, wiped out every last Amalekite, because he leaves King Agag standing. And so Samuel, when he comes in 1 Samuel 15, he ends up thrusting King Agag, the Amalekite king, through. And you think, OK, well, now all the Amalekites are gone, right? Wrong. There are lots of Amalekites still around. But I thought Saul did the job on all the Amalekites. He did everything except kill the king. And OK, he left some animals around, too. But that was it. Well, no, this is, again, typical military language that often engages in hyperbole and rhetoric. Even when it uses language of man, woman, young and old, that doesn't at all preclude the notion that there are actually women and children there. In fact, we'll talk about this later. There's very strong reason to talk about the target being combatants rather than non-combatants in this warfare. So as we look at 1 Samuel 15, we keep on reading. Don't just stop at 15. Keep going. We see David in chapter 30 engaging an Amalekite army. in fact, an army so large that 400 of them escape from David's clutches. So 1 Samuel 15 is talking about military engagement, and there are more soldiers even beyond that point whom David takes on. When we look at even the cities of Jericho, Ai, and other cities, these are actually not population centers. This is something that a lot of people do not recognize. But these are not places where the civilians would hang out. These were citadels or fortresses that guarded the hill country. And so before the civilians could be attacked in any way, you had these first lines of defense, citadels like Jericho or Ai and other Canaanite cities that were to protect these civilians. So you had in these cities, these were centers where you'd have the kind of the military king, the person who was in charge of the military. You would have the religious leaders, the priests and so forth. You would have political rulers and so forth. But this was not the place where civilians would typically live. You might have a tavern keeper like Rahab, but that was the exception. That wasn't where the families typically stayed. And so when you get to these cities, these are, in fact, even Jericho itself was probably comprised maybe 100 or fewer soldiers. This was it. It wasn't this grand populated city that are maybe our children's storybooks, Bible storybooks tell us were there. But rather, these were more military installations. In fact, as you look at the pottery in these places, you don't see, kind of high social status ceramic pottery there. You just kind of see the run-of-the-mill pottery that was used by the military. It's very functional and so forth. So this is not the place where the range of the population stayed. In fact, well, some people say, well, doesn't it talk about thousands of people in a city like Jericho? Well, yes, the number that is used, Eleph, can sometimes be rendered, is commonly rendered, thousand, but it can just simply mean unit or squad without specifying the specific number. And from what we know archaeologically, the numbers were quite small. We could also talk about how the Canaanites refused to acknowledge the one and true God. Another bullet point here. Rahab and her family were living demonstrations that the mission of killing the Canaanites was not absolute and irreversible, that God opened up the door for salvation for the Canaanites. Not that people took him up on the offer generally, but this was certainly available to people. In fact, Rahab herself becomes incorporated into the people of Israel, indicating that God is not concerned about wiping out Canaanites. He's happy to see Canaanites actually enter into a relationship with him, to become part of the people of God. Israel isn't engaged in a sort of genocide or ethnic cleansing by any stretch. In fact, later on, not only does Israel take in Rahab and her family, just as it would accept Ruth, but God is regularly reminding Israel to look out for the alien in their midst. Why? Because the Israelites had once been aliens and strangers in the land of Egypt. And what's also interesting is that God regularly threatens to judge Israel, just as he eventually did that, but he would judge them just as he did the Canaanites. In fact, Israel, when it is judged, the same language of extermination, of destruction, of wiping them out is used when they are going into exile. The same language is being used. But do we see that all the Israelites are totally annihilated when, say, or the Judah, when the Babylonians come in? No, we see large sectors going to Babylon, and we also see a large number of people staying behind. Again, nothing like the total annihilation that is often conjured up in the minds of people as they apply it to the Canaanites. This, again, the same language that is used of the Canaanites being wiped out is the same language that is used of the Israelites being wiped out in exile. But we don't see literal extermination here. Another bullet point to keep in mind here is this: driving them out. The language of driving out the Canaanites predominates the biblical text from Exodus 23 onward, that you see that God is really not concerned about wiping out, but more driving out or displacing. And this language of driving out does not mean, oh, they're going to be annihilated. No, because Adam and Eve, the same word is used of their being driven out of Eden. David is driven out from the presence of Saul. Again, doesn't get killed, but is simply displaced or moved away. And so as it's interesting that the language of driving them out is at odds with the language of utter destruction or obliteration. Expulsion is in view, not annihilation. And as John Golden Gay, one Old Testament commentator, writes, he says an attacked population wouldn't just wait around to be killed. Only the defenders who didn't get out would be the ones who would get killed. As Jeremiah 4:29 says, at the sound of the horsemen and the bowmen, every city flees. They go into the thickets and climb among the rocks. Every city is forsaken and no man dwells in them. Richard Hess at Denver Seminary argues that we have no indications from the biblical text that the justified wars of Joshua were against non-combatants. Indeed, we read in Joshua and Judges that despite the obliteration language, there were plenty of Canaanite inhabitants who weren't driven out. Rather, they lived in areas where Israel had settled. And as we've seen, archaeology bears this out, that there was no massive military assault that took place against the Canaanites, but rather a gradual infiltration that took over two centuries to accomplish. Another point, we're told that Joshua destroys the Canaanites according to all that Moses had commanded. He utterly destroyed them just as Moses commanded. Joshua 11:12. Joshua captured all the cities of these kings and all their kings. He struck them with the edge of the sword and utterly destroyed them just as Moses, the servant of the Lord, had commanded. Joshua 11:14 and 15. They left no one that breathed just as the Lord had commanded Moses, a servant. So Moses commanded Joshua, and so Joshua did. He left nothing undone of all that the Lord had commanded Moses. And you get, there's several texts that speak this way. So here Moses is saying, utterly destroy them, leave alive nothing that breathes. And then we read in Joshua that this is exactly what he does. He leaves alive nothing that breathes. The only problem is that there are a lot of Canaanites left alive breathing. So it's not as though Joshua is literally carrying this out, which must mean that Moses was not speaking in any literal way when he's talking about leave alive nothing that breathes. There was a very noteworthy language of hyperbole in the ancient Near East. And Joshua is one example of the many texts that could be brought to the surface to illustrate how this language of exaggeration is indeed utilized in war texts. So as we look at the question of what the scriptures say about the Canaanites, we see that it's far less clear, and I think far more encouraging as we look at this, very troubling texts, as we at least read some of them without reading the others to balance them out. We are left with another picture, aren't we? In fact, the skeptic cannot have it both ways. It's very interesting that the skeptic will say, well, how could God command this sort of a thing to happen? Well, okay, are you going to take that language literally? Or are you going to take the language of survivors literally? Because you have both. And you can't simply play one, the harsh text against the very clear text of survivors being left in great numbers. We could also ask the skeptic, does he believe that that these things really happened, that the Israelites really did go into the land of Canaan, and that they really did bring a decisive military victory that basically obliterated the Canaanites in their midst? If the critic says, yes, I do believe that, well, archaeology is against him. Because archaeologically speaking, we don't have that. In fact, as I said, if we look at the biblical text more clearly, we don't see that dramatic military incursion, but we see a lot of inner tussle, a lot of infiltration, a lot of struggle, but not that decisive military conquest. Another question to ask, does the skeptic believe that Moses commanded the literal annihilation of the Canaanites? If so, then why do they not take it literally that Joshua obeyed all that Moses commanded, but still left lots of survivors? Does the skeptic believe that the Old Testament didn't use hyperbole and rhetoric in warfare texts? Well, then what does he do with clear indications of rhetorical exaggeration in other ancient Near East war texts, where we clearly know that this was hyperbole, like the Moabite king who says that Israel is no more? So there are a number of points that we can rightfully bring up to the critic and say, well, if you're going to say this, if you're going to take this literally, well, what are you going to do with this? And so there are a number of questions that we can rightly ask of the critic. Now, let me just wrap up with a few final reflections. One of the things that is illustrated as we look at the Canaanite question is this: is God justified in bringing punishment to these Canaanites? Again, we've seen that it's really targeting Canaanite religion and morality rather than Canaanites themselves, that God is more interested in disabling the Canaanite structures than in removing, destroying the lives of Canaanites per se. As we look at this, we see that judgment is indeed central to this very motif of striking down the Canaanite religion. And this, of course, involves putting to death those who are upholding Canaanite religion and morality or immorality, something that would be, again, it's a just punishment for the Canaanites who are engaging in this and refuse to repent. But it's also preparing the way for the coming of the Messiah. But in our language, in our society, we don't really think of the language of judgment as being appropriate. But I think it's helpful to round out our time before we get to the question and answer time to quote the Yale theologian Miroslav Volf, who was born in Croatia and lived through the nightmare years of ethnic strife in the former Yugoslavia, including the destruction of churches, the rape of women, the murder of innocents. And he, at one point, as a young theologian, thought that wrath and anger were beneath the dignity of God. But he came to realize that his view of God had been too low. Here, this is Wolf. He puts into perspective the complaints about divine wrath and judgment. He said, "I used to think that wrath was unworthy of God. Isn't God love? Shouldn't divine love be beyond wrath? God is love, and God loves every person and every creature. That's exactly why God is wrathful against some of them. My last resistance to the idea of God's wrath was a casualty of the war in the former Yugoslavia, the region from which I come. According to some estimates, 200,000 people were killed, and over 3 million were displaced. My villages and cities were destroyed, my people shelled day in and day out, some of them brutalized beyond imagination, and I could not imagine God not being angry. Or think of Rwanda in the last decade of the past century, where 800,000 people were hacked to death in 100 days. How did God react to the carnage? By doting on the perpetrators in a grandfatherly fashion? By refusing to condemn the bloodbath, but instead affirming the perpetrators' basic goodness? Wasn't God fiercely angry with them? Though I used to complain about the indecency of the idea of God's wrath, I came to think that I would have to rebel against a God who wasn't wrathful at the sight of the world's evil. God isn't wrathful in spite of being love. God is wrathful because God is love." Some thoughts for us to ponder as we look at the question of the Canaanites. But what I'd like to do now is just go into a time of question and answer for you all. Thanks for bearing with me very patiently. I've gone a little bit over time, but I wanted to give you the opportunity in the next however long, half an hour or so, to ask whatever questions you would like to ask, and we'll take our best shot at it.